On the agenda today, we will have a work session for the purpose of, don't get too excited out there, for the purpose of considering measure drafting and introduction requests. We've actually scheduled three measures for hearings and a fourth measure for a hearing and possible work session. So we're going to start with the opening of work session on measure introductions.
Madam Co-Chair, you have two items in the memo. One is from Senator Carno and Representative Butler, a draft request for filing with Senator Carno and Representative Butler to honor former Representative Deputy Denny Jones. You have also LC 3477 relating to the Office of County Surveyor. This is a draft that you had previously approved. There's a third item that's been added, and that's from Senator Ringo regarding smoke detectors. It's a draft request that would require carbon monoxide detectors in homes. Those are the three. I have copies of two of them, which I can give to any member who would like to look at it.
Do we have a motion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Carno.
I move the bill drafting and introduction request presented by the staff be approved.
Senator Carno has moved that the measure drafting request presented by staff be approved. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the motion carries and the requests are approved. Thank you. So we're going to close the work session on measure drafting and introduction requests. Could I have Representative Randy Miller and Senator Richard Devlin come forward, please? For the students that are here, as a courtesy to the legislators in the room, because they have, most of them have fairly busy schedules, we like, when they come into the room, we let them testify first. So.
And they're really old.
Okay. That's Senate Bill. Okay. I'm going to open a hearing on SJR 11 and Senate Bill 457. Please proceed. Whoever goes first.
This is a dynamic duo.
That has never been used to describe those two gentlemen.
Dynamic.
Senator Devlin, I'm going to have the committee administrator give us a brief summary of the bill.
Madam Chair, SJR 11 is a constitutional amendment that would need approval by the voters of the next regular election. Amends the Constitution to require annual sessions of the Legislative Assembly. And then SB 457 increases the number of signatures required on a petition to request a municipal audit.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. With the committee's indulgence, and I've talked to the chair about this, the state treasurer is unable to be here today, but wanted to enter a letter into the record on annual sessions and actually wanted the letter to be read before the committee. So I will try to be as speedily read it as I can.
Senator Devlin?
Yes.
With all due respect to the treasurer, could we hold the letter? And we've got several people that need to leave early. So could we have you read the letter later?
That would be fine.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, then to my prepared testimony on SJR 11. Members of the committee, Madam Chair, I'm here to testify on behalf of SJR 11, a bill that will introduce annual sessions to the Oregon Legislature. What this bill does, SJR 11 proposes a constitutional amendment to the Oregon Constitution that requires annual legislative sessions. It requires that the session in odd-numbered years not exceed 120 calendar days and during even-numbered years not exceed 45 calendar days, and both commencing on the second Monday in January. The bill allows extensions by affirmative vote of two-thirds of the members of the Senate and the House. If passed, this bill refers the proposed amendment to the people of Oregon for their approval or rejection at the next primary election. The history of annual versus biennial sessions is long. In the early 1960s, only 19 state legislatures met annually. The remaining 31 held biennial regular sessions. All but three, Kentucky, Mississippi, and Virginia, held their biennial sessions in odd-numbered years. 10 of the 19 states with annual sessions limited the off-year to consideration of budgetary or fiscal items. By the mid-1970s, however, the number of states with annual sessions grew up tremendously, from 19 to 41. However, several of these states used a flexible session format in which the total days of session time was divided between 2 years. These states included Minnesota, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Vermont. Today, 44 states meet annually. The remaining six states, Arkansas, Montana, Nevada, North Dakota, Oregon, and Texas, hold their session every other year. All of the biennial legislative sessions occur in the odd-numbered year. Six states have limited scope sessions, that is, their 1 year of the biennium is limited to consideration of specific types of legislation. The states with limited scope sessions are Connecticut, Louisiana, Maine, New Mexico, North Carolina, and Wyoming. There are a lot of good reasons to have annual sessions. This is an issue that's been debated before this body many times. I just went back to 1995 when then Representative Bev Clarno introduced H.D.R. 40. H.D.R. 40 passed both the Senate and the House, but neither the Senate nor the House could ever concur on the exact version of annual sessions. In 1997, H.D.R. 34, sponsored by then-Senator Randy Miller, passed again both in the House and the Senate, but neither the Senate nor the House could concur in amendments. In 1999, S.D.R. 15, again sponsored by Senator Miller, passed the Senate and was recommended to pass, I believe, on the day before the session ended in the House from the Rules Committee and was at the Speaker's desk at the time of sine die. I think Senator Miller and I stepped back a little bit in 2001. Senator Miller introduced a bill, but it simply went to the Senate Rules Committee and was not heard from again. There are many good reasons to have annual sessions. Legislatures continually look for ways to improve their effectiveness. One of the reforms that has often been considered in the last two decades is annual sessions. One of the reasons that this has been brought forward is very clear, and let me give you very quickly seven of those. The biennial format is unsuitable for dealing with the complex and continuing problems that confront today's legislatures. Two, annual sessions of the legislature make it more a co-equal branch of state government. Three, continuing legislative oversight of the administration becomes more feasible with annual sessions, and the administrative accountability for the execution of legislative policies is more easily enforced. Four, states may respond more rapidly to new federal laws which require state participation. Five, the legislature cannot operate effectively in fits and starts, i.e. special sessions. Annual sessions may help make the policymaking process more timely and orderly. Six, the legislature will be able to address more effectively the complex issues it now faces. And seven, something probably dear, near and dear to the hearts of every member here, annual sessions would serve to diminish the need for special sessions. In closing, Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a bill that has been seen before the committees, rules committees, many times before. It has at least gained majorities in both chambers in this building at least several times before. There is a lot of merit for its consideration. I hope that you will soon hold a work session on it so that we can pass it and so that we can get it an earlier consideration on the House floor before the final day before sine die this session.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. Representative Miller.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, State Representative Randy Miller, District 37. I appreciate the opportunity to be before this committee today, and I appreciate Senator Devlin's recollection of times when bills I supported got double figures in terms of votes.
This
is going back a ways.
Didn't take much research.
It did to find those with double figures. Actually, I could go back even further at a time when this concept passed when I was in the legislature in 1989. This was pushed forward to the statewide ballot in May of 1990, and the proposition of annual sessions only lost by 5,000 votes. 49.9%, I believe it was, 49.6% of Oregonians favored the concept then. And I think in that intervening time, we've demonstrated, in my judgment, a real need for annual sessions. As some of you may recall, if you were tuned into the statewide debate at that time, the fear that was put on the people of Oregon was that we would become full-time professional politicians, apparently being here all of the time. The language in this bill strictly limits our time, and as you all know, we would be here under the terms of this bill for a shorter number of days, a fewer number of days than we have been averaging over the last
10 years of sessions, by quite a bit, actually. I think our current average is somewhere in the 185-day, 190-day range in their unlimited biennial session. By its terms, this is 165 days. And that doesn't count the specials, if that's what you were referring to. What I do think would happen that would be beneficial is having fixed target dates. Again, I'm talking to people who know this system so well, but I think we manage our time better. We force ourselves to make decisions. We require work get done, and we do it. And I also believe that it gives some predictability to those who choose to come to this process from other pursuits. They can tell their employer or whoever they're working with that I will be back in the office or the place of business at this time. And you can point to it with some certainty on the calendar and say, I'm going to be gone for 4 months, or I'm going to be gone for a month and a half in the case of this bill. And there is a high likelihood that you will meet that target. The high likelihood can be imposed for two reasons. One of them is that an extension period, and I have not seen the latest draft of this bill, but one I would recommend to the committee if it's not provided, is an extension of 5 days would be allowed if two-thirds of each chamber vote to allow the regular session to be extended for a five-day period. All of us, as a practical matter, know that if the leadership came to us and said, you know, we're real close on this, give us some time, maybe we don't take the full five-day extension, but that's all we want, most of us would likely yield. The second one would be very difficult to get. And I think that's an important proposition. The other thing that I believe would allow us to stay within these time frames is the fact that, in my judgment, for the first time in the history of the state, the interim process would become meaningful. We now study things, we write reports, and we deliver them to whom? The next group that's elected. Some of the new folks aren't necessarily bound by the work product of the prior group. Sometimes there are changes in leadership. Sometimes there are ties. But those are, I think, practical considerations as to why, if you are developing proposals, you bring them to the same group that's now in existence and you act on them. And so that work you did in the interim, to me, makes a lot more sense, a lot more valuable. Richard has done a nice job of comparing us with the other states in the United States. Only six of us approach sessions this way. I think it's time that we moved on to annual limited sessions and conducted our business, I think, in a more responsible way. With that, Madam Chair and members, I appreciate again your time and be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions for these two on this issue?
I have a question.
Senator Corcoran.
The difficulty I've always had with the annual sessions is twofold. One is that a 45-day window, even in a 120-day window, makes it very difficult for people that live far enough away from the Capitol that they have to get a place of residence in Salem when we're in session. And the other thing that troubles me about it is I think it's very difficult to recruit rank-and-file Oregonians to run for public office, to run for the legislature, because of the time constraints and the economic constraints. I go on a leave without pay. I've done it for 5 sessions now when we're in session. I understand this would alleviate that a little bit because it would be shorter than the 180 days. But I just think that it would make it even more difficult to recruit, a certain group of people in the state to run for office. Those are my two concerns.
Any responses?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Corcoran, I've heard that similar concern raised over the past number of years. My hope was just the opposite result would happen, that the certainty built into this package would allow somebody who is employed and has to take leave to define to their employer that this is the period of time you will be without me. Hopefully, by saying you're going to have to lose me for 4 months, as opposed to, well, gosh, I'm leaving the second Monday of January. I hope I'll be back. I think hopefully is advantageous. I understand from, and I don't rent here, so I don't know that practical difficulty. As you're working through this bill, one of the things I think probably strike Oregonians is unique how we might massage the days here, but frankly, I would be comfortable moving the number of days to accommodate those who do rent. The 120 perhaps could be, if you wanted to move that to like 130 to allow somebody, because there, maybe we don't make it out of here on the last day of the fourth month, but the landlord says, well, gosh, you're going to have to rent the whole next month even though you're here for three or four days. I mean, that's a practical consideration, maybe addressed by either shortening that number, lengthening a bit. Same with the 45, and at 45 is middle of the month. Nobody comes here and probably is convenienced. So,
Senator Devlin.
Madam Chair, my first actual encounter with this bill was at about 4:30 in the morning. It's listed officially in the calendar as having been considered on July 4th, but it was actually, I think, considered on July 5th at about 4:45 in the morning, 4:30, when then Representative Beyer presented it to a very tired House chamber. And most of the comments at that time were similar in nature to the comments from Senator Corcoran. And I think what Representative Beyer asked at that time for people to consider were the policy implications of it. We know that it's inconvenient. We know that it's going to take a little bit of adjustment. The common remarks that we've received is in terms of how will I find an apartment? Can I obtain staff for a short period of time? Those are all legitimate concerns, but we think that the policy implications of continuing to meet biannually versus annually far outweigh those inconveniences. And I do actually concur with Representative Miller in terms of the issue of recruiting people. One of the difficulties I think that there is that we can tell people when the sessions start, but we can't tell them when they end. And I would think for someone that's in a normal employment situation with an employer, not being able to tell the employer when you will come back is just as much a problem as if you have to leave twice in a two-year period, or as many of members here had to leave five times during the special sessions.
Thank you. Senator Klarner, did you have a question?
Sure do. How did you arrive at the 120 and the 45? Is that open to change, or can you tell me why those two timelines?
Madam Chair, Senator Klarno, actually the 120 and 45 have been the most common dates used in all previous bills since 1995. I did not look back into the 1980s, but those were the common dates, and I think that we're subject, obviously, to change.
Another question?
Sure.
Is that the way most states that have annual sessions design it?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Klarno, that is actually a good lead-in. I won't try to explain what every state does, but I have a handout here that explains what every state does in terms of their session lengths.
Thank you, Senator Delvin. We'll look forward to reading the handouts.
Thank you. One more question.
Go ahead.
Sure. I notice you don't say anything in the bill about that our exorbitant pay would be reduced if we don't adjourn. Are you just assuming that once the session ends that the pay would end as well? In other words, how many times could you continue the five-day extensions?
I don't have the bill right in front of me.
Okay, it says under subsection 2, by an affirmative vote of 2/3 of the members of each house, you could extend for one or more periods of 5 calendar days by the affirmative vote of 2/3 of the members of each house. I'm just trying to see if that's something that would be done time and time again.
Senator Klarno, I do remember in one of the iterations of this proposal, it said, you know, after you've gone the extension the first time, you can stay there for 5 more days, whatever you want. You're just not going to get paid. Now, if you wanted to write that into the bill, that's up to this committee. I really believe that most of us would be sensitive to staying around past the a very public targeted deadline.
Yeah.
And that the one extension could happen, but I don't think would be a regular feature. The other thing I would say about the number of days here, and I don't think I'd want to conceal this from anybody, but as I've suggested to the committee, to me the interim days would become meaningful. And no kidding here, the work we would do in between these sessions would probably be greater than we do now, because it's my experience you can participate kind of casually, and again, when you don't think the product necessarily matters, you give that sometimes. Some might give that kind of effort. Whereas if you're preparing for the next session, you're probably going to devote a lot of hours and that aren't going to be reflected, frankly, in what you're compensated. But I think that's...
Just a comment. I guess I think, and I understand what Senator Corcoran is saying, I think one of the things that's most difficult for me and on many other legislators that I've heard of is the uncertainty of our life here, where when the date that we will end the session. And that uncertainty, as I've gone around talked to people about doing the public service to come to the legislature, has bothered a lot of people, not only in their jobs, but the uncertainty in their life, their children. It's very difficult, and I know that if I had a time certain, I'd certainly be a lot happier about knowing when I was going to get out of here. I think the travel thing or the rent thing that Senator Corcoran mentioned, I remember in 93 when we were here in the longest session in history, and many of us that rent had to keep asking for an extension on our rent, and the people that were gone for the summer and wanted to come back to their homes couldn't understand why we were still here. And we didn't know either. But I just think the uncertainty is so bad now, and I also think in this time of the budgets that we have, to not be able to be here to have oversight is just obviously not a good thing, and to be able to be here on a regular basis and annual sessions would be a lot better for the government oversight and certainly for our lives as well. So I applaud you for bringing this, and maybe Senator Miller, since we've gone this road before, we better start driving the road together. As long as you won't go 70, I'll ride with you.
Senator Burdick, did you appreciate it?
Don't mention the speed limit, please. Thank you, Madam Chairman. We, as everyone knows painfully, we're at one of the most difficult periods in our history, really, in terms of the budget problems that we have, and especially the good Representative Miller is intimately aware of that, both of you, actually. The legislature has never been the most popular of institutions in Oregon, and during and after this session in particular, I expect to see a lot of public frustration because of some of the very difficult budget choices we're going to make, either cutting programs or raising revenue. No matter what option is taken, it's virtually guaranteed to cause a lot of hostility and turmoil in the public. And I guess my question is, have you thought about that, and do you think this is the best time to pursue a constitutional amendment, given the fact that our always tenuous public approval rating could be at an all-time low?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, I believe it is a good time. I think that the public understands the complexity of some of the issues facing the legislature. I cannot recall the exact date of this, but I do remember both what Representative Miller highlighted, the vote that the public had before that was very close, and I also remember several years ago seeing polling on annual sessions that showed considerable public support, more than 50% at that time, if my memory is correct. Not a lot more, but more. I think it's an issue of reality today. 44 out of 50 states have annual sessions. We have some very complex issues to deal with, and I think the public understands that. I think the real reality for our session, this session, is, and I could be speaking out of turn here, but when we leave this session, one of three things will happen. Either our forecasts will be exactly correct, which they've never been, or our forecast will go down, which we will be back in session, or our forecast will go up. And given the nature of the cuts that we know that we all face, if our forecasts do go up, there will be a lot of public interest on us getting back here to restore some of those items that we may have cut more deeply than we thought was a good policy, but necessary because we did not have the dollars to fund those programs. So I think regardless of, unless the first happens, unless our forecast is right within a few percentage points being right on the mark, we're going to be back here next year.
Madam Chair and Senator Burdick, I'm sometimes amazed at the number of people who think we're full-time already. And we tried to bear that out last year and be here full-time almost. But I think there are a lot of people who I've encountered, if I'm downtown Portland or something, somebody sees me and says, how come you're not in Salem? And it could be, you know, the middle of last year. And I'll say, well, gosh, we don't meet in this particular year, and it's news to them. I think they believe that a lot of us are here all the time. That having been said, I realize that we aren't held in the highest of esteem, but if this is one of those things, it's not going to have a big organization, a well-financed campaign to sell the idea. But it may have some editorial support, which is the kind of thing it probably needs to get passed by the people. The other thing, if it is probably principally stated that this actually limits the time we would be here, that could be appealing to those who don't think we're the greatest outfit ever assembled.
I just wanted to commend you. I know there may be a little disagreement, a friendly disagreement with my esteemed colleague here, but I wanted to commend you for not putting something in this measure to basically punish legislators if they go beyond the period. I think the two-thirds vote is very appropriate. I agree with you that it would not be used excessively for political reasons, because it would look very bad to the public to just extend things out. But to put a requirement in there, I've supported this measure in the past and voted against it because of that requirement in there, which is to me a poison pill, because it puts people in severe jeopardy if they're going to run for the legislature to tell people that they may be financially compromised by their service in the legislature. They may indeed have to choose between continuing their service to the end and going into debt. I don't think that's something that we can ask of people that we are asking to serve in a citizen legislature. And I in reality, around here, in a bipartisan legislature, I can't imagine a case where we would get a two-thirds vote on anything around here without a major consensus. For example, if the budget were not balanced, then it's perfectly appropriate to stay here and to be at a full level with all 90 legislators here. So I commend you for taking that approach rather than something punitive to keep us from extending on and on.
Thank you. Senator Atkinson?
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this forward. When I first began in the House, I was entirely against this, and now I am entirely behind it. I think this is a tremendous bill, and I remember the conversation you and I had on the Senate floor last time about the dates, which I do support, even if this committee would take some amendments to make the dates fit perhaps a rental agreement, I think is fine. But one of the reasons that I support this so strongly is hearing from constituents and my own experience of how we budget. I mean, we pass the most important budgets, everything that we all consider as most important, education, public safety, human resources, those three items. We pass those budgets at the end of session, which is usually a month longer than it should have been already. And we spend the most money at the end after we spend and passed out smaller budgets, less controversial budgets, and we leave those groups no time to budget at home. And I think how and the timing of when we pass those budgets is one of the reasons why the public doesn't trust us. And so just to build or perhaps add to what Senator Devlin said, I think we are going to come back next time, and there is some discussion of passing a one-year budget on some items and coming back, even having a trial annual session next year formally. But I would just like to say to this committee that if we don't move this bill, I hope that we would. I think one of my favorite things of the Rules Committee is it's usually the most progressive committee in both chambers. So it's the risk-taking committee, and I like that. But I have thought about introducing up one of my priority bills, a bill less as interested as or less wide as this bill, and introducing a measure that just introduces an end date. Because without an end date, it's very difficult on someone like I have my own company. I started my own company. Not having an end date has just been terrible. 5 special sessions was miserable. That's what I signed up for. But on the outside real world element of this, observing is very difficult. So not only do I support this, I hope we move it, but I think that it would restore the end date argument alone could restore some faith in how we do budgets here.
Thank you. Representative Miller, do you wish to testify on Senate Bill 457?
I'm here in favor of it.
Thank you.
It has created, as you know, some practical problems for smaller cities, one of which you will hear about, the city of River Grove. And I hope this committee takes a look at how we can prevent a situation where someone perhaps using the audit function for reasons other than being interested in the results can cause a small community or city to have some real financial difficulties. That's the nature of it. Thank you for your consideration.
We are honored by your presence here today.
Well, it's always a delight to see all of you.
Senator Devlin, do you have any testimony on 457?
Madam Chair, yes, I do, but I can wait till it comes up in normal consideration.
Thank you. I would ask that you do that. I've got a couple citizens that I need to have testify and get on the road. So.
Should we wait till these guys leave or shoot this dog?
Paula Crane?
We have to stand ever so when the bids leave.
SGR 11, I've already got a public hearing.
5 minutes. I don't think so. Go ahead if you
want. SGR 11.
Are you doing students now?
No, I got to get
All right. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of SJR 11. For the record, I am Paula Crane, and I'm representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I'm sorry, I had a cough, so I just put a cough drop in my mouth from being so noisy back there. The League is a nonpartisan grassroots political organization that encourages informed citizen participation in government and which provides voter service activities, which I think you're all familiar with. The League reaches its legislative positions after research, discussion, and member agreement. We have supported the concept of the Oregon Legislative Assembly meeting in annual sessions for many years, for as long as I can remember. SJR 11 proposes an extension of the work of the Assembly by adding a second 45-day session in even-numbered years. While the League has supported annual sessions for more than 20 years, the economic and social service crisis in which the state finds itself today points clearly to the need to set fiscal policy more frequently than every 24 months. In essence, with 5 special sessions in 2002, the Assembly did meet annually out of necessity. And we just heard you're probably going to meet this session. By planning for 2 sessions with time limits, it should be possible for the legislature to more adequately address fiscal policy and budget matters, as well as devoting adequate time to the social and safety matters important to Oregon's citizens. The League supports SJR 11 and the need for public discussion on this issue. We urge the committee to move this proposal to the Senate floor so that the voters can have the opportunity to consider the value of annual sessions with time limitations. While we are not proposing a specific amendment to the bill, we would suggest that the committee consider identifying some specific focus for the second session, such as physical policy. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Any questions? Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for your service. I'm going to close a public hearing on SJR 11 and open a public hearing on SJR 27 and ask that just carry on. President of Portland Community College, and come forward. Did you want to bring Jan and other folks? Okay.
SJR what?
SJR 27. Do you want to give a brief summary?
Yes, this is SJR 27. Also would amend the Constitution on approval by voters of the next primary election. This would eliminate the double majority requirement in property tax elections.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to submit some written testimony on behalf of this bill from President Rick Levine of Rogue Community College, who asked me to enter the record. So,
I would ask that you not read the testimony today. But having met President Levine, I'm delighted that he is supportive of this measure. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jess Carrion, President of Portland Community College. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you on behalf of the elimination of the double majority. As you know, the double majority requires that at least 50% of registered eligible voters participate in the election, and that at least 50% of those turnout vote yes in order for a local property tax to be approved in any election other than the general election. Let me tell you how this affected PCC in our 2000 bond measure. We placed a bond measure for $144 million on the ballot in the May 2000 primary. PCC is in all parts or parts of five counties, so it cost the college $135,000 to appear on the ballot in all five counties. We were concerned about the turnout issue and discussed with all of the county clerks whether or not their voter registration records would be updated to remove dead people and non-residents from the rolls. We were assured that all counties intended to update the voter registration list. We spent more than a year getting information out about the measure and worked with a volunteer campaign committee that raised $150,000 for the campaign. We passed the measure in May with a 57% yes vote, but lost the election because of our turnout was 49.6% rather than 50%. We needed 2,000 more people to vote, and they could have all voted no, and we still would have passed the measure handily. We achieved the sufficient voter turnout in all of our counties except one, where the clerk had not had the time to clean up the records. The clerk and the five counties all handled the issue of cleaning up the voter registration lists differently, and as a result, PCC lost the election. The college went back to the voters in November 2000, this time passed the measure with 64% of the vote, so in the end we achieved the desired results, but at a significant expense to the college and the taxpayers. We paid another $135,000 to get the issue back on the ballots in our five counties, and we will pay an estimated $1.75 million in additional construction costs due to the inflation over the last 6 months we've lost. The campaign committee went out and raised another $100,000 from the community. We believe at PCC that the double majority places an undue burden on local districts trying to work with our local communities to pass local option or bond measures. The double majority, in essence, gives a no vote to non-voters or dead people who have not been removed from the eligible voter list. It makes it much more difficult for local districts to get approval of these measures in times outside of the general election when the ballots tend to be more crowded and our issues get buried in all the legislative races and initiatives. This provision seems unduly harsh, and I urge you to support this bill to give local colleges and schools more flexibility in approaching our local communities for support. I appreciate your time and will respond to any questions you may have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any questions?
I'm just here to respond to questions. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rem Nimitz. I'm with the Oregon Community College Association. And I'm simply here to say that the Oregon Community College Association also supports the repeal of the double majority. I want to let you know that all 17 colleges are on board with that as well.
Great.
Just want to get that on the record.
Thanks. Appreciate you joining us today. Is there any questions? We'll let these folks go. Thank you.
Thank you.
And then, Paula, I'm sorry, I didn't see you had signed up for SJR 21. Is she still here, Paula Crane? I'm sorry, do you want to come up and submit your testimony? I'm going to close the public hearing on SJR 27 and open a public hearing on SJR 21.
Madam Co-Chair, SJR 21 does something extremely similar. Amends the Oregon Constitution upon approval by voters next primary election to eliminate the double majority requirement for property tax elections.
And for the folks in the audience, what are the two differences between the two measures?
They are minor. The 21 has a dash 2 amendment, which you have a copy of, that would further change the difference between the two. And maybe if you look at the dash 2 amendment, it talks about eliminating the double majority requirement in May and November elections only and moves the effective date to include the May 18th, 2004 primary.
Right. Okay. Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you again. Again, thank you for letting me speak on this issue. For the record, I am Paula Crane and representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And I'll skip all the other part and say that we are here today to support either of these constitutional amendments to repeal the double majority requirement in property tax elections. The League of Women Voters believes that responsible government should be responsive to the will of the people. The League strongly believes in the democratic process, and the double majority requirement does not allow for this process to work. It allows for a minority to control the election and the tax process. It does not allow for stable funding for the services dependent on the property tax. It is bad public policy because it allows people who do not vote to frustrate the will of the people who do. Even if 49% of eligible registered voters turned out and 99% of them voted for a measure, the measure would fail. This frustrates the will of the majority and works against the government by the people. For these reasons, the League of Women Voters urges the passage of one of these bills. My original thing says we prefer SJR 21. I haven't looked at the amendment, so I can't say whether that would be true. But in the original, we prefer SJR 21, but can support either bill. We would be happy to work with you on encouraging the voters of our state to pass this ballot measure, and we will be there during the election process if you pass this on to the voters.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or anything?
Questions. Senator Beyer. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to phrase this by saying that I personally did not support double majority when it was passed. I think that maybe, it was a wrong thing to do to reward people who don't vote. But I would like to point out that the statement you made that says it allows the minority to control the election tax process as an inaccurate statement, because a majority of people in the double majority did not vote. So the majority of people did not vote.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that I just like to point out that is actually an inaccurate statement.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Is Senator Ringo still in the room? Did we lose him? Okay. Senator Ringo, if you're listening to this, we would love to have you. And he might be right outside. Senator Devlin, why don't you come on up? Which ones are you wanting to test for, SJR 27?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on SJR 21 and SJR 27.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Chairwoman, members of the committee. I'm here to testify on behalf of SJR 27. SJR 27 is a replacement of the existing double majority requirement. Upon approval by voters in the next primary election, this bill will amend the Oregon Constitution to replace the double majority requirement in property tax elections and require that property tax measures be submitted only at general elections or in special elections in any May, in either the odd or even numbered year. My bill would limit property tax elections to 3 elections every 2 years. Currently, general elections are exempted from the double majority requirement The primary election in even-numbered years is generally within range of meeting the double majority requirement, and the May special election in odd-number years has changed significantly in recent years. You may all remember that some years back, I think it was actually only a session or two ago, we moved all school board elections and all special district elections to the May election. Also, it's become quite common in this body to refer measures to the May odd-numbered year election. In November 1996, I should remind people that Measure 47 was passed, further limiting property taxes and introducing the double majority requirement. That particular measure was so flawed, so poorly written, that the legislature felt that it needed to replace it with a measure, but at the same time needed to respect the public's will in Measure 47. So we referred Measure 50 to the voters in 1997, and the voters passed Measure 50. Less well known is that we already also referred to the voters Measure 53, which was an actual repeal of Measure 11, or of the double majority requirement, and that that measure actually failed with the public. SGR 27 is revisiting the issue to change the double majority requirement, but we want to make it clear that this bill's intent is not necessarily simply to repeal the double majority, but to put in place a real replacement for it. The double majority was put in place to deter jurisdictions from placing property tax measures on special election dates, anticipating low turnout, and focusing solely on supporters to pass certain tax measures. The double majority requirement, however, had reasonable intention, but the implementation of the measure is the antithesis of a participatory democracy. This requirement has created inefficiencies, as you've heard of, in our system, causing many measures to be referred multiple times to the ballot despite broad public support. This requirement has also given greater weight to electors who fail to vote. The double majority actually encourages inaction and non-participation by those who oppose property tax measures. A failure to vote for a tax measure actually has more weight under our current system than a vote in opposition. Madam Chair, members of the committee, many years ago when I was a young man, I read a quote that was from a speech by Teddy Roosevelt that I've always kept in mind in terms of what a real participatory democracy should be. And in that speech that he gave in 1910, he said that it is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how strong the man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails at least, fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who have never known either victory nor defeat. Now, you can't quite make the analogy to voting, to being that valiant man, and I do apologize for the time, understanding that in Mr. Roosevelt's time he used man in this kind of a speech rather than simply a generic term. But I think what he was pointing to was our ideal in a democracy. This is a republic form of government, that is true, but we encourage our citizens to take an active and involved role. The double majority is the absolute antithesis of that. We are rewarding people for not participating. I urge your passage of this measure. I would support Senator Ringo's measure if it got to the floor. My only concern is I want to put a measure on the ballot that actually gets rid of the double majority that's approved by the voters, and I am concerned that a mere repeal will not be approved.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. Senator Ringo, welcome back.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Senator Charlie Ringo, District 17. First of all, on annual sessions, I can tell you my wife will not let that happen. She told me that. I have some students behind me that are from Sunset High School in my district, and I met with them before Christmas, and I said, you know, I really like to see students involved in the legislative process, and I'll introduce a bill for you no matter what. And you can help usher it through. And I thought they might pick something that would, shorten the school year, longer recesses, or something like that. But no, they came up with repealing the double majority. And I think it really shows how attuned they really are to what is holding back some funding issues on our schools, and I think it was a really is a testament to them that they would choose this. I introduced the bill, and I don't need to repeat everything. I think there were some legitimate reasons why the double majority was passed, and I want to talk about those for a minute. The rationale was that schools, fire, police, library, whatever, would kind of be sneaking on certain things during an election cycle, and people weren't really paying attention, some weird July election or February election, and that wasn't right, because people would suddenly notice their property taxes would go up by increments when they weren't really paying attention. And so the double majority says that there's got to be the majority of 50% voting turnout, except for general election. It doesn't apply in a general election. And I think that that there's a compromise there along the lines of what Richard is suggesting, so that we're going to retain the double majority requirement for oddly timed elections. And I think really that makes sense. I have amendments very similar to Richard's. Richard's would allow three elections during a two-year cycle where a double majority wouldn't be required. I think it's easier just to say a double majority shall not be required in any election that's in the month of May or the month of November, because those are major elections. Those are elections where people are likely to be paying attention, if they're going to be paying attention at all. And so for SJR 21, I have some -1 amendments that would make that change. And so I think that the concept is right. I also just want to point out that on the House side, there's a similar resolution that's signed on by about 5 Republicans and 5 Democrats. It really has wide bipartisan support. This is a very, very important issue for my community, for Beaverton. Right now, we're having a bond levy, local option levy this May that will potentially raise $18 million for our school district. And I am sure that the local folks will work very hard to get it passed, and I'm quite sure that it will get at least 50% of the vote. Now, whether there's a 50% voter turnout is going to be the challenge, and I think it would be a real shame if that fails, just because a lot of people aren't engaged in the political process, and by staying out of the election process, essentially cast their vote against taking care of our schools. So I really appreciate your hearing this. And when the high school students come up here, please ask them a lot of hard questions and grill them really tough. So okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Any questions for these two? Thanks.
I'd also just ask, my bill is better than Richard's bill. Okay.
Great. We would like to have Sarah Roeder, Shannon Mills, and Jess Andrews. Why don't the three of you come up? Do you guys take the afternoon off from school to be here, or did you have a day off?
We got out early.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Rader, and I'm a member of the Sunset Advisory Council. At Sunset High School, students are taught the value of a vote and the importance of democracy. I feel that the double majority rule is a threat to democracy, and it should be nullified indefinitely. Not only is the double majority rule an insult to American democracy, it is impractical and a waste of Oregon taxpayers' money. It seems absurd to even hold a May primary if the voter turnout is too low to pass a bond measure, even if the majority of the voters support it. For instance, last May, the state voter turnout was approximately 42%, so no revenue measures were passed. But why only revenue? Why should local levies that support schools, fire districts, parks, and libraries be the ones that suffer when other measures pass despite the minority voter participation? Another consequence of the double majority rule is the amount of money spent to determine not only the eligibility of voters, but also the eligibility of non-voters. The county clerk's total of potential voters is erroneous in that voter deaths, relocations, name changes, and limitations imposed by federal law are often included in the final tally. The impossibility to enforce the double majority rule with any accuracy often leads to confusion and court challenges. These challenges are costly and can delay election results. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Andrews. I'm a junior at Sunset High School and a member of the Sunset High School Advisory Council. I and the other members of the Sunset High School Advisory Council feel that the double majority rule is undemocratic in nature. Instead of encouraging potential voters to vote, the double majority rule allows those who oppose the ballot, proposed ballot measures to simply not cast their vote. This rule gives more power to those who choose not to participate than those who make the effort to vote. It makes it very difficult for supporters to propose ballot measures to make progressive policy, as it gives the opposition an unfair advantage in the democratic process. If a person wanted to cast a vote against a proposed ballot measure, they should take it upon themselves to do so, instead of allowing the state to do it for them by not voting at all. This rule also sets a bad example for future voters, for example, members of the Advisory Council and their peers, as it promotes non-participation instead of participation in the democratic process. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Shannon Mills, and I'm a senior at Sunset High School and also part of the Sunset Advisory Council. SJR 21 would give voters the chance to repeal the double majority rule as it applies to May elections. I support this because, with the current state budget situation, it's necessary for localities to be able to fund their own programs and services with local money. Areas of Oregon from Redmond to West Lynn have been severely affected by the double majority rule. Attempts to fund services like schools, firefighters, and libraries have been struck down, not because a majority of voters opposed them, but because a majority of voters were too indifferent to vote. Should students suffer because so many citizens reject their constitutional right to cast a ballot? Should criminals be released and policemen fired because many Oregonians refuse to take the time to vote? The answer is no. Repealing the double majority rule will give us the ability to protect our local services while the state legislature repairs Oregon's revenue system and while we wait for the economy to turn around. Allowing a non-vote to count as a no vote harms our communities and takes power away from those who care about our state while putting it into the hands of those who do not care. I urge you to pass this resolution on to the voters.
Any questions for them? Okay. Do any of you think that the voters will actually change their minds? The voters passed this, what, 6 or 7 years ago. Do you think the voters will change their minds?
I hope so, especially now that our state is going through such problems with finding a budget that can support all of our services. I hope that voters will see that we need to fund things like schools and libraries and parks, and they'll realize that this is one way that we can do that by allowing these property tax measures to go through in May elections. I hope they'll see that better than they did when they first passed this.
Jenny? Sarah Berta.
Thank you. One thing that the double majority did is it pretty much forced a lot of measures to be on the same ballot, in the November general election ballot, to be sure that they didn't have to worry about the double majority requirement. And that gave the voter a chance to look at a number of proposals for more property taxes and decide which among them they wanted. Some of them, all of them, none of them. They could see them all together at once. And I just wanted to find out if any of you are concerned about a problem that I've thought about, which is maybe if you let these measures be doled out piecemeal, whether you limit it to May and November or any election, whether you risk having voters say, gee, that sounds like a good idea, and then 2 months later another one comes on, gee, that sounds like a good idea, and then one day the voter wakes up and says, I can't afford my property taxes anymore. Let's do a property tax limitation, and then guess what that affects? That affects schools. So do you worry about that? Is that the other end of the equation? The equation we're talking about here today is the services that these revenues provide, and you don't want to give people a vote just for not showing up. But on the other hand, if you make it easier to support these things, what about the high property taxes that result?
Personally, I have thought about the other side of the equation. However, I feel that our position in the end will weigh out and it will be more significant. And that's what voters will find as well.
Your position that
This should be repealed.
I agree with the amendment that Senator Charlie Ringo had made, that it should be repealed for only May and November, because those are when the voters are most knowledgeable about the topics that are the issues that are on the ballot.
Okay.
Thank you, and I agree with you. I think that's a good compromise to just one of the things that happens in some of the counties, some of the areas of Oregon, is just in terms of logistic, to have to wait for a general election. If you're talking about, I sit on the Sheriff's Advisory Committee in Multnomah County, and a jail levy was needed right away, and, you know, to wait a year and a half, you're literally letting prisoners out in the street. Thank you. You guys made an effective argument. Thank you.
Thanks for coming today. Okay, next two students, I have Chris Reifer and Andrew Simon. Shorter?
Yeah. I actually don't have very many people. I know. I hear you.
Go ahead, you guys.
I guess I'll start. Senator Brown, Senator Clarendon, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Andrew Simon. I'm a freshman at Sunset High School in Beaverton School District and a member of the Sunset High Advisory Council, which worked with Senator Ringo to draft SJR 21. Today I'm here to offer my support of SJR 21 to eliminate the double majority voting requirement in property tax elections. Although it isn't part of my history class, I've learned how the double majority requirement came about in Oregon. In 1996, there was a double majority requirement put before the voters in ballot measure 46, and more than 88% of the voters opposed it, believing, as I do, that the voice of a majority should prevail. At the same time, the double majority requirement was buried in measure 47, a long measure to cut and cap property taxes. And when the tax measure passed, so did the double majority requirement. A year later, voters replaced Measure 47 with Measure 50, another complex property tax limitation measure that unfortunately left the double majority requirement still in there.
Andrew, do you remember how ballot Measure 50 got to the ballot?
I do not remember.
Okay. Well, it was the legislature rewrote ballot Measure 47 because it was legally inconsistent and technically problematic, right. And so we sent out ballot measure 50 as sort of a cleanup to ballot measure 47. So, but the other part of history lesson is great. Thanks.
Okay. And even though I cannot vote yet, I know that the double majority rule violates the principle of one person, one vote. It allows an election to be determined by people who do not vote. This certainly is not the democracy we learned about in school, the democracy that is about participation, and those who choose to participate should determine the outcome of an election. Since it has been a part of the Oregon Constitution, the double majority requirement has created many problems. For example, in my district, the Beaverton School District, there was a bond measure on the ballot in 2000 to construct and improve schools, which is much needed in our Beaverton School District. And even though an overwhelming majority of the voters approved this bond, it did not pass because under 50% of the voters cast their ballots. The district then had to spend more time and energy and money to put the ballot to put the bond on the ballot again, and a much better use of these resources would have been spent in the classrooms or in other places. And I know that similar things have been going on in other school districts and with levies for libraries, sheriffs, and for many other things. As my classmates and I learned about our civic responsibilities, we're disappointed to think that the will of the majority of voters can be frustrated by people who do not vote. The double majority requirement is not fair and not democratic. We should let the people who vote decide elections instead of the people who do not vote. Please refer SJR 21 to the people of Oregon. Thank you.
Thanks. Chris?
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Reifer. I am a student at Sunset High School, and I come to you today in support of SJR 21. Since its passage, the double majority rule has made it very difficult for many of Oregon's social programs to receive funding that they desperately need. I am bringing to you three examples. First, our schools have become some of the worst funded in the nation, and the fallout has been catastrophic. Today, Portland Public Schools, Oregon's largest school district, has the shortest school year in the nation. This is a tragedy for students, as they do not have the same access to education that students in other states may have. But it is also a tragedy for teachers, as they are losing nearly a month of pay now. Public safety is also one of the most important things that a state funds. And Oregon's public safety program has suffered grievously as a result of lack of funding. Today, police departments around the state do not have the resources to pursue and prosecute criminals, thus making Oregon's streets more dangerous. Several counties have also had to release criminals from their prisons, as they no longer have the funds to incarcerate them. The fact is that our police departments do not have the resources to fight crime with origins both domestic and international. The park system has also suffered as a result of the double majority, thus reducing the quality of life in Oregon. It is well known that one of the most important factors for attracting businesses to Oregon is the quality of life, which includes urban beauty. The city and state parks programs no longer have adequate funds to maintain and expand their parks programs. This has had a detrimental effect on Oregon's cities, which were once nationally recognized as being among the nation's most beautiful. Now, all of these programs would benefit from being able to raise money in May elections without having to pass the very difficult 50% voter turnout standard. Thank you very much for your time, and I will be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thanks. Andrew, I'm going to throw this question to you because of some of the information in your testimony. And a few years ago, Oregon voters passed a law called Death with Dignity, mm-hmm. and the Oregon legislature decided that the voters needed another look at it, or really wanted to make sure the voters really meant what they said. And so we passed out another measure basically saying, did you really mean to pass the death with dignity measure? And it passed by several more points the second time around. How would you make the case for us sending out the double majority requirement on its own to the voters at this point in time?
You mean since you've sent it out before?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the death with dignity example is a little different because there really have been no major events then that have changed the public opinion on that. I think with this double majority requirement, people have seen the bonds and levies that have been attempted to be passed by the voters, and many people have been frustrated at that. And I think when it was originally passed, people didn't really realize the effects it would have. And now, after time, I think it would be appropriate to send it back to the voters now that more people have realized the true effects of the double majority requirement.
Thank you.
Senator, Madam Chair, that is an excellent point, because in the case of death with dignity, the legislature sent out the law literally before it had even gone into effect. So nothing had changed in the environment. They had no experience with it. It was just a flat out, we think need another look at this, whereas you point out very correctly that we do have experience with this, and it's maybe time for a second look. So I think that was a great answer.
I'd just like to compliment you and the three ladies that came before you on your wonderful testimony, and we really appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks for being here. Okay. Next up, John Marshall and Lori Wimmer. And then it looks like we'll have the city's folks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association, and I won't try to outdo the folks that preceded me, but there are some issues that I'd like to bring to your attention. I agree with the comments made earlier by Senator Ringo that there was a rationale for the double majority when it was first enacted in considered by voters and enacted in 1996, but I think those times have changed. There was a time in Oregon, in fact, when I first started with the School Boards Association, that school districts had an unlimited opportunities for local elections. We didn't have any set statutory dates. The legislature then moved to give us 8 dates a year, and over the course of time, we've been narrowed now to down to 4. So the idea that somehow school districts, cities, counties, and other units of local government are trying to sneak under the radar screen of voters, I believe, is unfounded. Now, also, all elections are vote by mail. And, in fact, vote by mail ballots now are required to contain on the outside in red an indication that there's a tax measure vote included. So voters are given ample opportunity to vote because the ballots come to the mail to all registered voters. There's also a clear indication on the ballot, on the outside of the envelope, that it's a tax increase. And as I said, we're now limited to four election dates a year. So I think the idea of stealth elections is unfounded and no longer rational. And we would encourage you to consider giving Oregonians another opportunity to look at the double majority. You will hear, I think, some stories about the complexity of trying to determine exactly who's eligible to vote and therefore who ought to be counted when it comes to determining the correct turnout. It doesn't take a genius to realize that if you drive through your neighborhood and see for sale signs on houses, many of which are empty, that those folks may have been registered voters and will be expected to be included in the double majority count, but no longer reside within the district. And while the county clerks, I think, try to do their best to purge voter rolls, it's still a very complex issue, and oftentimes the numbers with which we're forced to work and will determine the outcome of our elections aren't accurate. So we would encourage you to approve a re-referral of a consideration of the double majority to voters. And while we'd druther have the double majority repealed outright, we would encourage you that if you decide that that's not appropriate, you would at least apply the double majority to March and September and leave the May and November election in both even and odd-numbered years where the double majority doesn't apply. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Thanks. Lori?
Yes, for the record, Lori Wimmer-Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. We, too, support the repeal of double majority requirement, which we have said for a long time we believe passed as a poison pill inside Measures 47 and 50 and not really were supported on their own by the public. And I would like to bring to your attention some research I handed you that we did on local options and bonds. Take a look at the 188 district bond levy elections since 1997 and 50 local option elections since 1999. And you'll see that there were 21 school district local option and bond levy elections that passed in terms of their yes-no vote but failed as a result of turnout. And while 21 may not seem like a lot compared to the total number, I would argue that that is 21 school districts and community college districts worth of students whose education was in some way impaired by being in overcrowded classrooms or schools with leaky roofs or popped windows or what have you, and not getting their science labs and technology and so on as a result of those failures of turnout, not of voter will. And so I think that it's significant even if it's not the vast majority of elections. As others have stated, and you certainly know, a good number of districts are forced onto one of the November ballots so that they can avoid that problem, therefore. And I think it actually crowds the election. I would respectfully disagree that spreading the district's opportunities is actually worse in terms of outcome for us with funding. I think it's actually worse when there are more of them on the ballots all at once. And that's because I think it's an overwhelming picture for a lot of voters, and so it actually may impair our ability to win with the yes vote in some cases. But more to the point, I would also echo those who have come before me that talk about the bad public policy it is to discourage voter turnout, but because there are those who are cynical. I remember reading about a worker from the Cascade Policy Institute who proudly wrote a letter to the editor recently that she was going to use the double majority turnout opportunity to stay home and basically have two no votes, in effect, by virtue of failure to participate in a special election so that she could ensure a negative outcome for that school bond election. And I'm not sure that's what we ever intended as good public policy with respect to democracy. And to that point, I'd also like to say that I don't believe that the failure of the double majority repeal in 1998 should necessarily discourage us from trying again for one reason, and that's the ballot title, and I'd like to read it to you. The ballot title that was on the May 19, 1998 ballot read, "Amends Constitution, eliminates voter turnout requirement for passing certain property tax measures." That is, in a word, terrible language. And we still came within 2.6% 6% of passage. Out of 623,000 votes cast, only 16,000 was the vote loss margin.
Lori, I guess I'm confused because ballot measure 46 2 years before was soundly defeated with 88% voting no on that, at least according to Andrew Simon's information, and I even actually forgotten about that ballot measure. Did the legislature refer
the double majority appeal?
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Came very close.
Thank you.
That's all I had.
Next up, I'm going to bring up the cities, Dave Barenberg, Chris Childs, Patricia Gray, and David Judd. Kapori, come on up.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dave Barenberg from the League of Oregon Cities. And you've received an awful lot of good testimony from the students and from the other legislators and officials who've testified, so I
and
will be
David,
brief.
I'm going to stop you. The students are leaving. Thank them for coming, being here. You guys were great. So we look forward to seeing you again on other issues. Thanks. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I thought I'd just make a couple points and then answer a couple questions that committee members had asked. The first is comment is when I was growing up, I thought that the only place that the dead could vote was Chicago. And then Oregon changed that with the passage of 47 and 50. And I think that comparisons in voting with practices in Chicago are probably not to the favorable for the state of Oregon. As regards to Measure 46 that, Madam Chair, you just raised in 1996, which was a measure that said non-voters should be counted as no's for property tax measures. I think you're accurate. It went down something like 158,000 to 1.2 million in terms of the voter rejection. And as Lori Wimmer said, Measure 53, which was just on the ballot very shortly after the passage of Measure 50 for the repeal of the double majority requirement, went down failed to pass 303,000 to 319,000, only by 16,000 votes. And I think, as the students and others have said, that clearly we've had a number of years' experience that we hopefully will learn from in terms of the problems that are caused by the double majority, and especially the changes that have occurred since we've gone to vote by mail, where every voter is hit in the face essentially with a marked envelope that highlights that there is a vote and they have the opportunity to participate. It clearly is anti-democratic. It clearly, I think, as the legislature has found in trying budget times, that there are times when one needs to go to the ballot more often than every 2 years. And this is something that local government has found is necessary as we do our annual budget processes. And many measures have gone down with overwhelming majority, 70%, over 70% of the voters voting yes, and sometimes going down by just just a handful of votes and lacking them the double majority. So for those reasons, we would urge your passage of SJR 21 and or 27. Clearly, we prefer just having it open to any ballot, but think that the points made by Senators Devlin and Ringo are good ones, and we would abide by the committee's wisdom and urge your passage. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Well, do you want to start with the North Santiam or the South Santiam?
Feel free to proceed however you wish.
Okay. My name is Pat Gray. I am the finance director for the City of Sweet Home on the South Santiam. I did a little write up here, and I was Senator Beyer was true to his point with the League of Women Voters that it was the majority that does turn down the levy by not voting. So you'll see some corrections as I go along with my testimony that I kind of penciled in that I kind of went, oh boy, he's right. Yes. So if you don't mind, I kind of read through. It's been a long time since I've come and talked to a board, a committee, and I thank you very much for letting us come. But I wanted to point out that the headline in Wednesday's Albany Democrat Herald newspaper read that the Sweet Home Library levy goes down. It just happened Tuesday night. And not to criticize the person that writes the headlines, but it is incorrect, in fact, that our Sweet Home levy was approved and was passed by the Sweet Home voters. It was passed by a 54% margin. But for all the good it did, despite the approval of the vote of 904 Sweet Home citizens, and this is one of the corrections I made when I said about 60 Sweet Home citizens, 1,792 of the 3,465 voters of Sweet Home decided to either toss their ballots in the garbage as junk mail. They decided that the levy could pass without their vote or went to get around it, to filling it out someday if they could ever find it again on their kitchen counter. But for whatever reason it was, these ballots were not returned to Linn County. In Sweet Home, our police and library services are totally dependent upon their four-year operating levies. When we cannot get one passed, there is no other way to fund these needed services for this community. Many people in the community are well aware of this fact and volunteer countless hours of their days, evenings, and weekends calling voters, soliciting funding, talking to community groups, and gathering support. So when levies that are passed by active voters, yet defeated by those who choose not to vote or forget to vote, these same good-hearted volunteers become very disappointed with Oregon's election system and are not so eager to jump right back up and help out again. And when defeated by such a small margin as in Sweet Home, our margin was only 60 ballots. We needed to have 60 ballots returned. It was not only frustrating for all the volunteers, but also for those 904 citizens who did vote for the levy. And for such a result comes a level of apathy from our voters of why should they should vote when this number of people can only decide the outcome of an election. 51% of the registered voters in Sweet Home decided the election Tuesday night by not voting. They did not vote. I do not believe this was the intent of our forefathers when they wrote our constitutions, both the Oregon and the United States Constitution, because in the United States Constitution it is written that the elections are decided by the majority of voters. Only in Oregon do we allow people who do not vote by choice or forgetfulness to decide the outcome of the election. Oregon's Constitution needs to be changed back to a democracy. And remember those days when you could vote yes for something because you support it, or you could vote no for something because you do not support it and you live with the majority, the decision of the majority. Another thing we ran into with our levy is that we have people who will take the system and in letters, this is out of our local newspaper, a reporter who worked for the newspaper wrote and said, don't vote. Don't vote. The city has one more chance in May. Even though the city's putting out $4,000 in election for each one of these, he writes to the voters and says, "Do not vote." If you do not vote, it's even a better shot. It will get turned down than it will be if you vote no. And that is what he's instructing the voters to do. And so the library people were very much up in arms and calling around because pretty much it even went to Lebanon that they were told, "Don't bother voting for the levy because." You can do it again in May. And then if it goes down in May, that's our third strike. We tried to pass it in November at the general election. We have two, like I said, the police and the library are in four-year rotations. We try to keep on the November election. And the concern was to keep the police levy going. We have tried for the last 6 years not to raise the taxes on our library levy, and we were only going out for 28 cents. So they voted it no on the library levy. And the people came, the friends of the library came back to the council and said, we believe we had spent a lot of our effort trying to pass the police levy. The library levy got left behind. We would like to try again in March. So the council said, okay, we'll go out again in March. This time, like I said, it passed. It passed by 54% margin. But then it failed. And now I have to explain to these people who are calling me saying, well, then why did I even bother voting? Because the people who didn't vote actually got to say in it. And right now as we're meeting, the friends of the library are meeting to come back to me tomorrow and tell me what they want me to take back to the council on Wednesday, because Thursday I have to have another levy filed to the county. And we're sure hoping third time's a charm, because when that doesn't pass in May by the majority, I'm shutting the doors. There's no money. And I'm not going to wait to September like he says, because retroactively I don't have the cash. Property taxes might be, you know, coming in November, but that library is totally sufficient upon the property taxes, and in fact borrows money from the general fund to pay its bills between June, July, because they had tried so hard and they work on such a part-time shoestring in that library. And even the Linn County clerk could not be here today, but he did ask that I throw a word in for him and support to try to eliminate the double majority for the headaches and the heartaches that it causes in their department, too, and in the elections, because John Ramirez said as they were going out the door Tuesday, why did it have to pass but yet fail? So we're just hoping the third time is a charm to the voters on trying to get the double majority eliminated.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Chris Childs. I reside at Staten, Oregon. I'm the city administrator for that city. However, I do want to point out, although logic suggests it should be the case, I'm not certain that I can claim that I'm conveying any official city position, but I clearly can say that I think I speak in the interests of local government units throughout the state of Oregon. I don't want to be redundant of some of the good information you've gotten from other people. I think maybe you've received my numbers. These are two quick case studies. September election in 2001, Sublimity Fire District. You can see that there was a margin. It passed by a margin of 244, but came up short 115 against the double majority requirement. City of Staten in November of 2001, which obviously is an off-year election, so the requirement held a 305-vote margin and only 29 votes short of meeting the double majority. I want to say that in that instance, our elections department was incredibly supportive and helpful to try within the means available to them to clean up the deadwood, but I think you know and I know that out of 3,300 people, there's bound to be 29 that are in transit in some fashion. I might add that in the Sublimity situation, they were trying to resolve a problem with a new idea. They walked away and continued to live with their problem. The city of Staten's problem was the situation was a little more critical because the proposed levy was replacing an expiring levy, so the impact was going to be even greater. So they redoubled their efforts, decided to spend another $4,000. Our elections cost the same as Sweet Home's, which, by the way, if I could put that in perspective, that's for us, that's equivalent to about a third of the value of the state cigarette tax distribution that we may lose depending on your May revenue forecast. But continuing on, in a what we call the old days, which none of you, I believe, are old enough to remember, but at the age of 23, I was once the youngest ever county clerk in the state of Oregon. And that was in an era when a school district, a fire district, a cemetery district could go out to the schoolhouse, open a polling place, and literally hold an election from 2 o'clock in the afternoon until 8 o'clock at night. I mean, you know, most of us, when we had polling elections, it was at least 8 to 8. So that's a thing of the past, as the gentleman from the School Boards Association, I think, and others here so aptly pointed out. The vote by mail thing has changed everything. As the lawyers always say, you have notice and opportunity. You have the constructive notice of having received your ballot in the mail, whatever you may choose to do with it. You have opportunity in that you have the opportunity to fill out that ballot and return it. And one last comment, I guess if I could be so bold as to make a comment on committee member Burdick was in questioning another presenter. You commented on the preponderance of the measures that occur in the November general election in order to try to, you know, avoid the double majority. And if I understood your perspective, that's a good opportunity for the voter to look at them all at the same time and see what's out there and kind of maybe throw a dart and make the choice. I can appreciate that perspective, but I want you to appreciate the frustration of all of those. I mean, I can guarantee, as a local government official, the last date I want to have to put it on is November to compete with everybody else, because the biggest check valve involved here in every county, as far as I know, about 5 days before that election, everybody in the state of Oregon gets their property tax statement. So having said all of that, I certainly I would support a full repeal of the double majority requirement, and at the very least some of the other amendments that some of the folks have discussed. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. It occurred to me while the two of you were talking that perhaps the double majority requirement is actually more difficult for smaller communities than it is for larger communities. Is that, in fact, the case?
I'm never having lived in a larger community. I don't know too much about larger communities. But it's very hard in Sweet Home, I know, for us to reach that double majority, and that's why and the property tax bill is an issue in November, and that's why we do try to get him on November. And we have failed before and it was interesting, last 4 years we went out, we had our police levy, we had our library levy, and then our police levy on the November ballot. The library levy passed, the police levy failed. We had to go out again in March, and then we had to go out again in May, if I remember correctly, and because it failed, and we finally got it like the skin of our teeth. This year, the police chief said, okay, no, I'm not going to fail this time. Put me first. So we were putting the police first and the library last. The police passed. The library failed. So they were appeared like they were approving taxes for the first one, but they said, okay, I've already paid my taxes. I'm not going to approve taxes for the second one. They get this mentality. I don't know if it's a small town mentality, but they get this mentality to do it. But, you know, even the hours that was put in on this, I myself took 10 pages of voter names and called people at night and to encourage them. We didn't tell them to vote for it. We told them to vote, just to vote, whether you voted against it or for it. You know, even if these 60 ballots had gone through no, you know, we would have felt better. I think they would have felt better that had they met their 50% and felt they reached their community. But the library and the Friends of the Library Political Action Committee did not feel, I believe, that they even reached the community because of the low turnout. And I was very surprised in myself and looking at the non-voter list when I ordered it, because now I'm data mining the registered voter list before next week when I turn in my levy for Steve Duckenmiller to start cleaning off people that are dead, that no longer live there, and we're using our records and records of people to contest it. But I was very surprised in the non-voter list how many school district employees did not vote, how many fire district employees did not vote, even how many city employees did not vote, no matter how many times we hammered them. And when I asked a few of them, he said, well, sorry, we threw our ballot away when we first got it. And think about it, we thought somebody else would, we thought it would go through. We didn't think our vote would really matter because it was such a given. It was going to go through. Everybody loves the library. You had such wonderful programs, such wonderful things planned with this money. And it didn't go through. And they were very surprised that, wow, it passed, but you're telling me it didn't pass because we were missing just 60 ballots? So just speaking from the small town side of it.
Madam Chair, it's been a problem for cities of every size.
Yeah, I'm looking at the list. May 2002, Enterprise was able to pass one. So was Tillamook, and so was Warrenton Hammond. But Central Oregon Community College, Echo, and Rogue and Mount Hood all lost. So I think it really varies.
Madam Chair, that's a great question, and you know, I too would not care to speculate. Other than, I think, as David says, I mean, at the very least, it's a matter of relativity. What costs us $4,000 costs Portland CC $135,000. So.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank the folks from my district to come in with testimony, or even testimony today. It's a long drive.
Thank you.
Sweet Home. State never applied so far, but still, thanks for coming today.
Thanks. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I just want to say that I went to first grade in Sweet Home.
That's a wonderful community, and don't forget, we have the Oregon Jamboree in August, the greatest country musical festival in Oregon.
Great.
First weekend in August. We'll be out of here. Yeah.
She said, we're hoping we'll be done with session by then. Senator Burdick.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to point out that in terms of the city panel, the mayor of Tigard would have liked very much to be here to speak in support as well. And the Tigard-Tualatin School District has actually overcome the double majority twice in the last 3 years, to their great credit. It's a wonderful community, and I'm sure he regrets nothing and would be here.
Okay. Thanks. Hello. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Brown and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak here today about Senate Joint Resolution 21. For the record, I'm David Judd. I'm the Deputy Director of Portland Parks and Recreation from the City of Portland. And also with me today is Reverend T. Ellen Bethel, who is a charter member of the Portland Parks Board, a citizen body of advocates and colleagues of the park system. I'm certain that our story in Portland is not much different than the painful stories you've been hearing all afternoon, so I'll keep this fairly brief. But maybe to speak to specifically to the point about timing of certain ballot measures being referred to the voters, the city's budget process usually begins in the dead of winter, and about that time a year ago, in January or so of 2002, it was quite clear that the city's budget picture was going to be very bleak, and early on it was clear that the impact on the park users in the city of Portland would be pretty profound. The closures of restrooms and maintenance in the parks, the termination of 7 out of 13 of the community school after-school programs, and a host of other cuts were necessitated by what for our agency was a $2.2 million cut. And there was considerable discussion about when that matter might be taken, what measure might be taken to the voters and when. But to avoid the disruption of service, which is a decision that many local jurisdictions have to make, it was decided that we would take the matter to the ballot in May of 2002. And after many other alternatives were examined, that seemed to be the best time, and we knew if it would pass at that time, services would not be disrupted. There was a lot of citizen support for it in the testimony before the city council. There was clear support in polling. And in fact, as the campaign organized, and $400,000 were raised and 700 or so volunteers were activated, it was clear that the community wanted the measure to pass. On election night, we were thrilled to see the first numbers go up on the TV screen that 70% of the voters had voted yes. And there was much elation among the volunteers. And of course, as the night wore on and the days after wore on, when the true turnout came to pass, we were saddened to learn that only 48% of the voters had appeared. The numbers were sort of stunning. The yes votes in favor of the measure, over 90,000. The no votes, over 38,000. So some interesting math can be done. With 6,100 more votes, even if all of them had been no votes, the measure would have passed. And even if all of the no voters, the 38,000 plus no voters, had brought a friend to the polls with them, or brought a friend to the mailbox and voted no, if all of the no's had voted again no, it still would have passed overwhelmingly. So our city council clearly saw that this was something the city voters wanted, the citizens wanted, and referred the matter back to the ballot again in the fall, where it passed again handily. But there is now, we're in the midst of the disruption of the services that were terminated for 1 year. And those closures of community school programs, after-school programs, park maintenance activities, summer programs are now in realities both the end of last summer and this summer. This great sort of beginning and shutdown and begin again process has caused a considerable amount of confusion. There's also a sort of a price to be paid with the second victory, if you will, in the fall, and that is that many voters in the fall were confused. They thought the measure had passed. Since it had such an overwhelming level of support in the spring, they could not understand why it wasn't enacted. And a part of the fundraising effort and the campaign strategy had to re-educate the voters that, in fact, this was not a new, separate, and additional park measure, but the same measure that had already been passed, at least by the the 70% in May. So as we went through that process, I think even today, as we prepare, hopefully, in July of 2003, when the programs can be restored, we are still dealing with confusion and frustration by the voters, by the public, and I think no one still understands the logic that those who didn't vote had, in the end, more influence on the decision here than those who did. Thank you.
You have any comments?
Yes. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Chow in Bethel. I am the senior pastor of Maranatha Church in Portland, Oregon, as well as a charter member of the Portland Parks Board in Portland. We have in primary elections, and you've heard many statistics and much testimony, so I will not belabor the fact of the statistics or the testimony, but simply to say that while one could possibly understand by asking for such a percentage of a double majority, that it allows a majority of people to vote, but it also allows not a small number to place a restriction or impose something upon all. But that's what our democracy is all about. The right to be able to vote, the right to be able to stand up and say, I believe in something and therefore I can vote for it and I'll suffer whatever consequences that may come if I choose not to vote. I do not believe that it is fair in our own democratic society and in this particular part of the double majority that people might have the power by just staying home. I believe that for voting rights, it's been fought a long battle. It has been for many people just to be able to reach the age of 18 and say, now I can vote. And you get that opportunity, and now you stay home. So therefore, again, last year, when many people worked so hard to pass the library and the parks levy there in Portland, all of the goodwill of the people was crushed. We indeed celebrated without all of the facts. We had a majority of votes cast. We did not have a double majority. We did not have 50% of people. We could hope that those ballots were stamped, sent back to return to sender, those great Elvis Presley songs. And we trust that they did not get a stamp put on them, but they were put in the recycling bin because that is the effect of what they had in that election. I believe that the measures on each ballot should stand by themselves and let the fate rest in the hands of we the people, without a requirement of a double majority for money measures. We as the people of Oregon have the right to make a decision, to cast our vote, to stand up, and to be counted for what we believe. We no longer need the stay-at-home political influence in primary elections to defeat money measures. Citizens should be courageous enough to stand up for their convictions. If not, they will fall for anything. Let a simple majority rule in all elections and on all ballots. Thank you very much for the opportunity to appear before you.
Thank you. Any questions? Appreciate you being here this afternoon.
Thank you.
Next up, is Steve Novick still here? Okay. Andy Miller, why don't you come up and we'll have you do both SJR 27 and SJR 11, if you don't mind. And Senator Devlin, why don't you come on up as well? And for those of you waiting for Senate Bill 457, we haven't forgotten about you. No, we aren't yet. Can I have Andy go first on SJR 27? Thanks.
Thank you so much for giving me the chance to talk to you today. My name is Andy Miller. I'm the executive director of Common Cause Oregon. I'm so excited to see all this support for this. This was one of our starred items on our legislative agenda, and I just asked Senator Devlin if he was surprised by this support, and he said no, so I think it's great. We strongly support the elimination of double majority requirements in property tax elections. We feel that the current requirement is confusing and undemocratic. It's a requirement that makes a yes vote a no vote. We support both SJR 21 and SJR 27 and have no preference as to which of these two proposed amendments you refer to the voters. I'd like to add also this we like to call the Sunset High School Amendment, which is a good way to look at finding a good solution. And also, as a former educator, I want to say that I think the Sunset students were a demonstration that our public schools really work. And I'm going to find myself an intern. Are you ready for me to go on with this,
Jared? I'm going to close the public hearings on SJR 21 and 27 and open the public hearing on SJR 11. Please proceed. Go ahead.
Okay. Again, for the record, Andy Miller. Common Cause supports the proposed amendment to require annual sessions of the Legislative Assembly. It's been become evident that the people's business cannot be accomplished in a single biennial session. Rather than rely on the decisions of the emergency board, which is not democratically elected, yet has all the authority of the full legislature, we believe that the annual session would be in the best interest of democracy, and we urge a yes vote on SJR 11.
Great. Thank you very much. Any questions for Andy? Senator Devlin, can I beg, plead you to just hand us Treasurer Edwards' testimony on SJR 11, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, knowing how to win votes and how to lose them, I will just ask that it be entered into the record, and I will ask you particularly to focus on the Treasurer's comments relative to how it might improve our budget process.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. Good job. We will formally enter Treasurer Edwards' testimony into the record, particularly noting the impact of annual sessions on the budget process. Andy, you can be excused if you wish. Senator Devlin, do you wish to testify on SJR 11, or can I move to Senate Bill 457?
Senate Bill 457.
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on SJR 11 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 457.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 457 deals with municipal audits. For the record, I'm Senator Richard Devlin from Senate District 19. This bill modifies the number of signatures required on a petition to request a municipal audit from 10 residents to 30 residents in a municipality with a population of more than 150. Once the petition has been received by the Secretary of State, then the Secretary has the ability to determine whether a municipal audit is required. I'm not going to read all of my testimony here. I'll probably try to give it to you later in terms of written testimony, if that's okay with the chair. But basically what we have here is a situation in state law that doesn't require very many cities to actually have annual audits. They're required to submit financial statements to the Secretary of State. But then under certain conditions, they are required to do an audit if 10 actual residents of the city request an annual audit. Now, the reason I brought this forward, and I don't bring too many bills of this type forward to the body, is I have a small jurisdiction within my district and within Senator Miller's district, who's also a chief sponsor of this bill, that has had some difficulties with one developer from the state of Washington. He has appealed numerous decisions of the city, knowing that the city lacks very much in terms of financial resources. He has filed numerous appeals, filed numerous cases in district court, and then he found this particular law that said that all he had to do is go out and get 10 signatures and that he could require them to go through an audit process. Long time ago, not really that long ago, I used to have a practice, and I'll make the committee here believe that I'm a little bit unusual for a legislator. One of my hobbies used to be to read budgets for cities and counties and special districts. I actually enjoyed doing that. And I at one time read the City of River Grove budget. And I can tell you that the budget, at least at that time, and I don't think it has changed very much, doesn't have a great deal in resources. It's a city of about 300 people with only about 150 actual residences, approximately 150, 150, 160. It might have increased a little bit with recent development. And this type of action basically puts an enormous amount of burden on a very small city. So we tried to strive for a standard that might put them in a better position. So that's why we said 30 votes or 30 citizens of the city, unless the city's smaller than 150, and then it would still be retained in the existing 10. My understanding is that the particular person that has been actually barraging the city with all of these claims may have already started the process on an audit, so there came to be a question after the bill was drafted whether the requirements in the bill could be made retroactive. Should the bill ever be considered in a work session by this committee, I will confer with legislative counsel and see if that's possible. I told the City of River Grove that I have seen bills that do have retroactive clauses in it. There are a number of requirements that I've seen before in terms of being able to do that, and I don't know in this particular case if it could be done.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. You're welcome to stay. Welcome your constituent up to the desk, or you're welcome to leave, whichever is your preference. But I think this committee thinks you need to get a life if you're reading budgets for fun.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would like to introduce the Mayor of River Grove. He's been a good friend of mine for a number of years. He actually does share a different political persuasion than I do on some issues. This is Mayor Barrett from River Grove.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks and welcome. And sorry it took so long to get to this bill.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for hearing me. Let me say in public that I very much appreciate Senator Devlin. He's always had a knack for the little guy, and he's showing his true colors and helping us out today. Essentially, what we have here, Madam Chair, is a...
Would you please state your name for the record?
Yes, Larry Barrett, Mayor of River Grove. We, for the last 6 years, we've had a developer that's come into our town and tried to develop. We have essentially only the parcels of land that he's purchased that are developable. Otherwise, we're completely contained within our urban service boundaries. And he's tried to develop these with some pretty outlandish developments, including building in the floodplain. Our planning commission has appropriately turned it down. He's appealed it to the city council. The city council has turned it down. We've gone to LUBA three times, been affirmed all three times at LUBA with our land use decisions. He's taken us to district court and sued us for writs of mandamus that didn't even apply. Most recently, the last two cases that we won. We're about $80,000 in debt in attorney's fees right now. What he didn't count on was that Preston Gates and Ellis is our city attorney, and the Gates of Preston Gates and Ellis is Bill's dad, and they have assured us that they won't let the city go bankrupt just for legal fees. However, those legal fees are ours, and we intend to pay them and find a way. We're hopefully going to try and get our legal fees through the courts. What this developer has done now recently, immediately having lost those two suits, he's served us with notice that he intends to bring an 11 count claim for tort action against the city, including civil rights violations. So he's trying to just run us into the ground. As I said, we're pretty well covered by a tremendous law firm that's doing a lot of pro bono work. So he found this law that says that he can audit us into oblivion. We have a general fund of $28,000. 100% of our revenues come from our fair share of cigarette and liquor taxes, and short of encouraging Oregonians to... yeah, I understand that may go away, too. But short of encouraging Oregonians to smoke and drink more, our budgets are etched in stone. Our discretionary income is in the hundreds of dollars, not in thousands. This audit that we're being forced to go through right now that we're... that he's made the petition for our 0203 budget, and it's going to cost us $3,000. We're finding pro bono CPAs that are going to help us out to cut that cost a little bit. But if he is successful next year in getting 10 people to, seven of which are in his development, so he just needs three people that he can get to sign this petition. Two of the three that signed it this time are personal friends of mine, had no idea what they were signing when they did it. If he's successful next year in getting 10 people and requiring us, we think that we will be forced into disincorporation. We're a small city. We're very efficient. We do lots of things for our citizens at no cost. We're a total volunteer. I'm a volunteer mayor, a volunteer city council volunteer, everybody. We have one paid employee, our county recorder. That makes even less money than you folks do, and you know how bad that is. And so we're very efficient. We provide services for our constituents that, if we were to disincorporate, would cost them elsewhere. They would. We know that, for instance, the city of Lake Oswego and Tualatin that we are in between have taxes, and it costs somewhere between $300 and $500 a year per resident. For the services that the city provides. We give that back to our constituents and have for the 30-something years we've been incorporated. So we're attempting to remain incorporated, and that's why I asked Senator Devlin to consider, if he could, the retroactive nature of this particular bill, give it back to this developer, make him go find 20 more people that would sign the petition. And I would even be in favor of an inclusion in the bill. Audits are very important. Municipalities and need to be held accountable, most certainly. We only write four or five checks a month to our light bill, our police and fire services, the contracts we have with the county and whatnot. So when I went to the auditor and told him what we had, he kind of laughed, but still, it's $3,000 because of the extensive work that they have to do, and perhaps Mr. Hopkins could speak more to the kind of work that they do. But the fact that that he's able to do this, you know, has some tremendous impact on whether or not we will remain incorporated as a city. And so that's why I came to Senator Devlin looking for help. I'd be happy to take any questions you have.
Thank you. Any questions?
Chair.
Senator Burrick.
As I hear your story, number one, I'm not sure this bill will solve your problem. And number two, I'm wondering if there is a cause of action of harassment against cities out there that that may be available. It sounds like a real nightmare.
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, very possibly we might be able to, but as I mentioned, we're doing everything pro bono and to try and ask our attorney firm to take additional things on is pretty much impossible for us.
Senator Devlin.
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, obviously this will not solve all of the problems that the city currently has in this particular relationship. I decided not to actually give my entire testimony, but in part of that I would explain also that the city has judgments against this party. The problem is that they are not enforceable in the sense of that the party is apparently judgment-proof for their attorney's fees. So.
Mayor Barrett, I guess my question would be, what happens in terms of incorporation if you need to incorporate? What's the practical impact of that disincorporation?
Yeah. If we disincorporate, we go back to the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon makes a decision as to we would not, from what I understand, go back into unincorporated Clackamas County. First of all, we span two counties, Washington and Clackamas, and so you know, we're that big. So we would not be simply just disincorporate and go back into the county, but there would be a jurisdiction that would be petitioned nearby to pick us up, and of course then they would ask for more tax levies that would incorporate our citizens and so on. So it would go back to the state, from what I understand.
Thanks. Any other questions for these two? Thanks for coming. You're welcome to stay if you want with while Phil Hopkin comes up from the Secretary of State's office here. Okay. Welcome. Last but not least.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Phil Hopkins, and I'm an audit administrator with the Secretary of State Audits Division. What can I help you with today?
I'm assuming you came to testify on Senate Bill 457. Will this bill assist the city of River Grove with their problem?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I came here today after reading the language that's in this bill. The Audits Division, well, maybe I could back up a little bit. The Municipal Audit Law, which is actually the Municipal Audit Act of 1941, put in place a mechanism whereby all cities, counties, school districts, community colleges, and all special districts in Oregon are audited every year. And so it is the set of laws in place where it allows citizens to get accountability for the fiscal affairs and the operations of the entities to which they are residents. And to that end, the Secretary of State is supportive of anything that, you know, enhances that program or makes it more efficient. What happens is part of that, we have 1,650 municipalities out there, 1,200 of which receive annual audits, and then we have about 400 very small entities whose combined revenues and expenditures are under $150,000 a year. And they're the ones who file these reports in lieu of audit and not subject to an audit. And that would include the city of River Grove. I think there's probably, I don't have anything official, but maybe three or four little cities and towns. But most of them are small water districts, special road assessment districts, and stuff like that. I've been with the Audits Division 20 years. In the last 10, I've been in the municipal audit program. And I would say that we probably had four or five petitions under this set of statutes where citizens have present a petition for an audit, and to that end, they have gone through, and obviously they are for small communities, and they have been performed, and they just kind of went away. I guess they got satisfaction in there. This bill here has a number of things. One is to change the population requirement, you know, and I mean, looking at that, I can see some rationale for it. I mean, if you had, I'll just tell you, the last petition we had was a very small city, 10 residents, and the population was 25. So we had 40% of the population wanted an audit, and the audit was performed, okay? On the other hand, if you had, say, 10 residents, and maybe there was 500, you know, we're only talking about 0.25%, and so you'd have a very small minority dictating whether the audit process is there. So maybe there's some rationale for that. I mean, that's your determination. But what I see, it's not real clear to us in terms of our audit function. The way the audit process works now is that those who are not already subject to an audit, if somebody wants a petition, our role as the Secretary of State is to receive the petition, ensure that we give notice to the governing body, and that they take action to contract to have an audit done. What it appears to be here is that it says once we receive a petition, it says the Secretary of State shall review the principles of accounting and methods followed by the municipal corporation in recording and summarizing and stuff. And when I read that, that's the language that is used that when you're already in the process of performing an audit. So I'm asking, so I'm wondering, is it this contemplate that the Secretary of State then gets involved in an audit? And then the second part, which is not in the current law, it says that not later than 90 days after receiving the petition, the Secretary of State shall determine whether or not it should be performed. And so what this does is this kind of opens up a whole new door. We're not involved in the audit process under this current statutes. And so now it's asking us to kind of come in and intervene whether or not they should be performed. Well, when you look at it, I got two parties. I have the petitioners coming to us and saying they want an audit. And then you have the governments who will say, obviously, no, I don't want an audit for one reason or another, and they're going to ask us perhaps not to do the audit. And so now this puts us at the local government level trying to make some decisions whether or not an audit is justified. The municipal audit law, the whole purpose of it is to have audits performed. And we've stayed out of local government issues in the past, and I don't know that we want to go there.
Thank you. I appreciate you raising these issues. I think at this point we'll close the public hearing on this bill unless there's someone else who wishes to testify.
Real briefly.
Sure, come on up.
Thanks. Shall we leave?
You can leave or you can stay, whatever.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities, and I just wanted to make clear for the record that we are supportive of the City of River Grove with regard to the intent of this bill and, you know, how to...
I think what we're going to do is put this ball in Senator Devlin's court and have him work with Secretary of State's office and make sure that the bill does what it says and what it needs to do. So thank you for coming, and I would be in touch with Senator Devlin if you have any concerns. Anything else, Jim?
That is it.
Okay. I think that concludes the public testimony at this point in time for Senate Bill 457. So we'll close the public hearing. And with that, and besides, since we have no one left except for Senator Burdick and myself, we are adjourned.
And I wanted to thank Phil. Thank you very much for coming, Mr. Hopkins. I was the one that actually happened to come to explain that statement that the Secretary of State...